A famous critic once said, of all the arts in the world, none is more fundamental to the way we live than architecture. Our homes, our public buildings, our cities reflect what we are, what we once were, and what we hope to become. Welcome to a conversation with Moshi Safdie, the architect behind the iconic Marina Bay Sands and Sky Habitat.
Moshi Safdie made his name as a young architect, designing modest public housing apartments in Canada, intended for ordinary middle-income families. But later, as he became well-known, he moved on to big billion-dollar museums and public libraries. And in Singapore, he designed a lavish casino and hotel-cum-shopping mall, which has become, perhaps unintentionally, Singapore's version of the Sydney Opera House, a building that everyone now identifies as representing this metropolis.
Moshi Safdie, thank you very much for being on Conversation With.
Pleasure.
Many people think that the Marina Bay Sands Sky Park is a phallic symbol. Is it?
I think it's all in the imagination of the beholder. To me, it's more of a spaceship in motion, a boat, a ship, even a skating board. But the phallic has to maybe turn upwards and be another direction.
Why the curve? Why was that curve necessary? Was it an engineering thing or something that you felt that you designed
all.
It in?
The curve is born in the site. But to give you the full context, the boulevard that in front of which the hotel is built is curved. The boulevard behind it is also curved, but it's a different curve. And I had to fit the hotel complex exactly in between. So not only is it curved, but the one face curves differently from the other. And as it comes to the peak, it forms a sort of compound curve. And the Sky Park just follows that curve, which is the curve of the Shears Boulevard. But then I thought it would be odd that the hotel is curved, and then the promenade that faces the bay is a straight line, as the URA had initially designed it. And so I asked for permission to modify it, rebuild the seawall as a curve as well. So when you follow the water, you're also moving at a curve. So the curve is very much of a powerful theme that follows the project level by level, but it's born from the site and the road system.
What about the Arts and Science Museum? I've been asked whether or not that's a pebble splash or a lotus. Which one is it?
Well, when I first made the sketches for it, Mr. Adelson, who's my client, said, looks to me like a bunch of bananas. So I figured I need to work more at it, refine the geometry. Next time I came back, he said, oh, now it looks like the hand of welcome. So for him, it's the hand of welcome. Most Singaporeans refer to it as a lotus, and I think that's the more familiar imagery. But I think hand of welcome is okay. And I do believe that symbolic associations with architecture need to be left to the interpreter. It's wrong for the architect to tell people, that's what I meant or that's my intention. If you've got to explain the intention, it hasn't done it. It hasn't worked. So you've got to create the setting for people to imagine within their own experience. And you will find that the association people have are completely different. As you said, a skating board can be for someone else a phallic.
So you don't mind that people come up with these rather quirky interpretations of what you've built?
I think that if, not only don't I not mind, but I think if it isn't happening, I have failed. Because I think the form of a building, which grows from within, from the program, from the site, all the elements that get fed into a design until it takes its form, should provoke. It should stimulate. It should excite. And as soon as that happens, people have associations. And in Asia, their imagination is much more expansive about that than, say, for example, in the United States, where people are quite shy to talk about symbolism in art and architecture. But in Asia, it's the stuff of life.
The other one that I don't know if you've heard is that people here in Asia say the three towers, tombstones, not so good on the feng shui.
As a matter of fact, when I made the first sketches with three towers, the Sky Park was symmetrical. It overhang equally on both sides. And the feng shui master said, tombstones, and he said more. He said it.
So you had a consultant, feng shui master?
Oh, yes, of course. You can't build in Asia without one. Also, he said it's associated with negative power, like the Japanese occupation. Well, I had to stretch my imagination. But if you're building for a community, you've got to consider sensitivities. And so that's when the Sky Park became asymmetrical, and I shoved it 65 meters in one direction. And I said, that's goodbye to symmetry. I think at that point, the Tombstone Association was dropped, but here I see that it never goes to sleep.
Feng Shui, you've just said that there was a Feng Shui consultant for this, but do you actually believe in Feng Shui?
It's difficult for me to say I believe it because I've learned that, like acousticians, you go to two Feng Shui masters and you get very different readings. I have that experience with acousticians because they always say, do this, you'll get good sound, but it's always a different story. So I think it's a culture. I think it is subjective, and I think you listen to it and you always take it with a little bit of a grain of salt, but that does not mean you can't go with the current. And for example, to my mind, making the project asymmetrical in response to his concern made the project better.
How much do you really know of, so to say, the culture here? To say that you'd be able to make it contextual, really lived in. A lot of the architects that we see now come not from Asia, but come from other countries, Canada, Israel, and come in and build buildings here. How much do you really know of, so to say, the culture here? To say that you'd be able to make it contextual, really lived in.
You're opening a subject that is a big debate in the profession today, because I would say, critically, I would say, that the majority of Western architects, but I could, Western in the more expansive, come to places and parachute designs which are very much part of their culture, their language, even their building technology. When you do this from New York to Tokyo, the two developed mega cities. But when you do it from, Germany or New York to the Punjab or to Lagos, you get some very strange distortions. And there is a minority school, of which I belong very passionately, that says you've got to design in the context of a place. And if you're going to be part of a globalized society, as we are, and you find yourself as an architect not building just in the culture that's familiar to you, then you need to learn the place, you need to study the place, your antennas need to be out there, you need to have a measure of humility. I learned it actually, I learned it from my first works in Jerusalem. After building in Canada, I came to Jerusalem, a historic city, very rich culture. And I realized that to make buildings that belong there, I had to kind of forget everything I learned as a student in Canada. I had to look at the texture of the place and the history of the place. And dealing with this idea that I will make buildings in Jerusalem that feel as if they'd always been there, that belong, taught me a lesson that then I applied everywhere. And because my own background is born in the East, educated in the West, back in the East, back and forth, and the Middle East culture is as much part of me as the Western culture, it's relatively easy for me. But then when I come to Punjab or when I come to China, I realize that I'm in territory which is not my culture, and I need to do a lot of work to pick up the vibes, whether it's the Feng Shui, whether it's understanding the climate, whether it's understanding the lifestyle that's unique. And if you're out there listening and observing, I think you'll make buildings that fit. And if you're arrogant enough to feel that where you come from knows best, you get all glass buildings in the middle of the desert, which is an abomination.
I'm talking about Abu Dhabi here.
Well,
Dubai.
For example, but you find some in Singapore too.
there. Would you like to name some of them?
No.
But how have you made, for example, Sky Habitat, so to say, Singaporean? A tropical, with our climate, with our rainfall, with our levels of sun. What have you done to this building to make it local?
I could tell you like a series of issues that we face here. First, very high density. Singapore is a city of density, but this is high density, 600 units on a rather small plot, high rise. Secondly, a context of high rise family living. This is for families. This is not for empty nesters and young people in Manhattan who live on their 60 meter apartment. This is for families, children, tropics. People want the little balcony or the terrace or the garden. And even though it's hot during the day, at night they love coming out into them and using them. And so these were the cues. Tropical, shade the building, lots of glass for view, but overhangs, balconies, shades, etc. A lot of community space.
Would you say, though, that you enjoyed building this more than Marina Bay Sands?
It's completely different, and it's a different agenda. You can't say more because I realized the burden of doing Marina Bay Sands. The expectations were extraordinary. Now, the minimal expectation was that it would transform Singapore economically. It would be jobs, it would bring tourism, and it would do that. But the maximum hope was that it would become like the word is icon, the hot word now, icon. That it would become iconic, that it would become maybe even the symbol for the place. Everybody said, we need the Sydney Opera House, we need the Sydney Opera House. What's the Sydney Opera House? It's a great work of architecture that came to stand for the symbol of Australia. And so in my hopes was that it would rise to that occasion. And I guess looking back now 5 years, it's risen to the occasion. I mean, I'm just observing rather than judging. And I think that that was a major agenda, which is very different. The contribution of this is to show that you can do housing in a better way in the high-rise context of middle-income housing. And therefore, this will have long-lasting impact on other projects as well and on my own projects. And so that the benefits are different in each case. It's like doing a National Gallery, that's one agenda, and doing a transportation center, that's a different agenda.
What is the lasting impact, you think, some building like this has?
That it shows the way that you can do housing in a better way than the common way of doing it.
Are you most comfortable actually building apartment blocks for ordinary people? Because that's how you started, your very first thesis and the thing that's really made you famous, some would say, was actually, again, apartment block, idea of public housing for ordinary families.
Well, you know, I've done everything from super luxury to housing for ordinary people. The level of reward when you do it for a larger section of society is much greater because of my upbringing. You know, I grew up in a new country that was idealistic and socialist and so on, and so that my disposition is to care, and I don't get that much satisfaction when I create apartments are going to sell for $10 million in New York. I mean, I enjoy it as an architect, but as a social being, this is much more rewarding. I remember doing a tiny project for a kibbutz in Israel, a cooperative community of young people who went to create their own agricultural village. And there were, I remember, it was 150 units. And seeing them move in with their children and all that was as rewarding as any major project that I'd done, just seeing it come to life.
Is it different, though, to build here than it is to build in the very dense cities in other parts of the world?
When it comes to the megascale city, the problems are generic and universal. The solutions vary because cultures vary. Income varies. Lifestyle, for sure, varies. But the denser the city, the more generic the issues. Daylight is daylight. I mean, it's true that building in Singapore in the tropics presents me with the opportunity to create this kind of a garden, which I would do differently in Montreal, Canada, where it's going to be covered with snow about 4 months or 5 months of the year.
What are you trying to do with the jewel at Changi? Outdo Marina Bay Sands?
A massive 54 million visitors pass through Singapore's Changi Airport every year. But the award-winning airport is facing rivalry from its neighbours. and has roped in Moshi Safdie to create The Jewel. A new retail and eating centre aimed at impressing even the most jaded international jet-setter.
What are you trying to do with The Jewel at Changi? Outdo Marina Bay Sands?
I think it's hard to outdo Marina Bay Sands, but what I'm trying to do is redefine what airports can be like. And also, I'm trying to do something very particular to Singapore. Singapore is the garden city of Asia, as we refer to it. And it is, in fact, the place of gardens. And I think that the Jewel is going to be the quintessential garden of Singapore, at the heart of the airport, kind of a paradise garden, with the water, the rain coming right through and being collected on the roof and coming right through the building in a waterfall. And I think that as such a place of joy, it'll also redefine what airports can be like. You know, we think of airports as machines, gets you from point A to point B. Now we think of it as a machine that gets you from point A to point B and spend as much money as you can in the process. So airports have become a combination of getting you through and getting you and becoming malls. And I think that airports actually should be places of the public realm. They should be places like the old railway stations of the 19th century. And I think Jewel will contribute to this advancement in airport design.
In other words, you want it to be a place where people hang out.
I want it to be a place where people hang out. And also, I like to say Singapore meets the world, world meets the Singapore, because people from Singapore will come to Jewel. Not to fly, but to be there. And people will come there as passengers in transit and otherwise. And so you'll get the two coming together in one place, which sort of serves both. And I think that's the exciting part of the program.
From a purely user perspective, though, my aunt, who saw it on television, said, isn't it going to be dangerous with this enormous waterfall?
Well, she's pessimistic about our engineering capability. I think it's going to be very exciting. I just came back from Los Angeles, where the world's foremost expert in water feature design has mocked up the vortex of the Jewel roof, set it up in the right height, which is, you know, 50, 60 feet above the ground, and pumped enough water to simulate a real downpour in Singapore, and projecting lights on it and all that. It's going to be absolutely exciting. And it'll be a way of experiencing the weather, although we'll, of course, pump water when it's not there. There'll be light shows on it. And all that water gets collected and gets reused in the garden and the rest of the airport. So it's also a good move in terms of sustainability, of showing physically how water can be harvested.
What do you do, though, to make sure that you don't get lazy? You're running these fantastic projects all over the world, but how do you make sure that you don't get intellectually lazy, that you don't just do a repetition of what you've done previously?
The way I do it, which is an issue, because particularly if you start repeating yourself in terms of getting the same issue, is that I seek different commissions that I have not done before, and I go after that particular way. You know, there was a moment where I got stereotyped in doing housing. So then I was doing museums, then I did a library. Then I said, I've never done an airport. I want to do an airport. I did Tel Aviv, and then I did Toronto. Now I'm doing my first hospital. So point one, do things you've not done before. And go back to first principles, because that's what you do when you do a new building type, and do them in places that you haven't done built before.
You are so much an architect, through and through, in the way you think, in the way you express yourself. Has it ever occurred to you, though, that one day that you could be something else? If you weren't an architect, what would you be?
It occurs to me too often. So for
a
long period, absolutely. Being a generalist in architecture, you're a generalist. You're all over the place. You're dealing with social issues, technological issues, political issues. And I guess I shouldn't forget that there's moments where I think I would have enjoyed making a difference where it really matters, which is in politics. And there were moments in my life where I said, well, If I was prepared to give up,
you could go into politics now.
I'm going to be 77 next week. It's too late. You should know when. In politics.
Oh, in China, 77 was the start of your career. In the old days.
That is true. But doing politics in China for me might be a difficult language issue.
Well, we're reasonably glad, I think, that you stayed an architect.
Thank you.
Moshe Safdie, thank you very much for being in conversation with me.
Thank you.